So I want to talk this morning about things I've been working on and thinking about in the last year and a half or so, which are really interesting to me, and I hope will be relevant to you, because I think these are universal kinds of questions. And when we come to the meditation hall and sit facing the wall, we have the opportunity to really meet ourselves. It might take a little while to meet ourselves. It won't happen right away. Maybe it will, but often it takes a little time to recognize that we're, first we're distracted by the difficulty of sitting and complications of the body and busyness of the mind. And after a while, we're able to actually get it, that the mind is making up stories. And we're falling for it. And I think it takes us a while to be able to make the difference between believing the stories and just letting them continue, run on. I was talking with a friend a while ago, and I mentioned that I'm taking a medical Qigong class, and that I was having some difficulties with it because I didn't feel I belonged there. You know, it wasn't a familiar space like this with familiar relationships. A lot of people, almost everybody I did not know, nor did I feel that I necessarily had the qualifications, the preparation to do a medical Qigong class. And he said, "That's how I feel. That's why I don't go to groups." And the difference between us was that I didn't believe my mind, and he did. So even though my mind said, "You don't belong here, everybody else knows more about this than you do, everybody else is legitimately here, and maybe you're not," I was interested enough in the subject matter, because it's about energy, about the body. And I felt it was important to make an effort to see whether, in fact, I might belong there. So I stayed with it for a while, and then I dropped out. And after a few weeks, I decided to go back. I was just interested enough. I felt there was some kind of hook in there for me. And especially the hook of my mind going, "Oh, you can't really keep up. You can't hear the teacher. You don't know what's going on. You're too old. You know, everybody else is in their 30s or 20s or 40s or something." So now I've been at it a little bit longer, and I've met some of the folks, and they're tolerating me. They're tolerating my inability not to quite hear and not to quite know what's going on. And the more I do the practice, the more I make the effort, the more I'm developing some relationship with what he's teaching. So what I want to talk about is the process of trying to stay with something that you don't feel you can, you really have any talent for. Um, When I first came to Tassajara in 67, Suzuki Roshi said, he was teaching that fall. He taught us the whole practice period. 68. It was 68, I think. And the main teaching I remember was his saying, become one with whatever you do. Become one-pointed or undivided. And one of our shared experiences is that we are divided with ourselves, against ourselves. Our mind is divided. Part of it says, yes, you belong. Another part says, what are you doing here? You know, you're going to hold up the class. The body may want to stay. The mind may not want to stay. We very seldom have a sense of wholeheartedness, completely in the same place, all of us. Mind, body, feelings, thoughts, everything. And the effort we're making, including today in Zazen, a day like today, when we devote the morning or afternoon, the whole day, to a simple, unadorned practice, no distractions, just sitting, following the breath, attending to the breath, being aware of our experience. Gradually, we are becoming more integrated. If we do this for 5 or 6 days, as some of us have, by the end of that time, we are really much more wholehearted or one-pointed. We're just sitting. There's not as much conversation going on in the mind because we haven't read the papers or talked with people or watched television or whatever the previous couple of days. And there's just sitting here remembering what it's like to sit on the cushion and feel the body, the pressure points, the stress of the body, the comfort or discomfort, the joy or the despair of the body. I want to encourage you today to, you know, once I quoted Gil Fronsdale's teacher as saying, some teacher in Asia, don't do anything that takes you out of your body at the beginning of a retreat in Burma or Thailand or someplace over there. And he didn't understand this. Don't do anything that takes you out of your body. To me, that means being in the body, staying with the sensations of the body. We can do that in Zazen. When we do that in Zazen, if we stay with the sensations of the body, that's the content of our period of Zazen. That takes us out of the thinking mind, complaining, wandering, discoursing. Takes us out of that mind into the sensations, wherever they are, in your back, in your hip, in your shoulders, your chest, wherever the sensations may be of sitting here for you, stay with them. That means when the end of the period arrives, your mind isn't filled with a lot of talk. You've been feeling the sensations. It's an interesting, different experience. And when we go, we can do this as we go walking in the walking meditation or the rest of our lives. We can be with our sensations. That will begin to cut through when we can, this is not easy. Many of us can't do it. I have difficulty myself, but sometimes I can come into the body. When we do it, more and more we can remember that we're in this body. And it takes us out of the wandering, preoccupied mind, which is taking us all over the place. So, I'm going to start with that, about the wholeheartedness of our practice and the effort to gradually pull all of our parts of this body and mind together and take us on another trip, which will end up at the same place. We are so fortunate to have a group practice where we can check in with each other, confess to each other what we do understand or don't understand or have trouble doing. And so we're not isolated in trying to follow the meanderings of the mind and the decisions of the mind and the complaints of the mind. You don't belong here. You're not doing this very well. Boy, you are doing this so well. You're probably doing this better than anybody. That one came, you know, that one came up once or twice until I realized how it was going for other people. That one shut down pretty quick. We have different practices in the Zendo and in Monterey that help us compare ourselves. And that comparative mind, as our teachers have been telling us forever, you know, is a great source of suffering. Because whatever it tells you isn't true. It's just what the mind is making up. It takes a while to realize you've fallen for it. But then when you catch yourself, it's just the mind following its patterns. It may be your mind or not. It may not be your mind in the sense that it's you, that you're choosing to have these thoughts. You're not choosing to have these thoughts. That's the teaching of Buddhism. These are karmic thoughts, karmically produced, karmically determined. We're kind of helpless in a way, all this stuff that comes up. But the choice that we have is not to fall for it, not to believe it. So I've been thinking, Wendy's tracking this, that many of us are living in fear a lot of the time. That became obvious to me in this class. I was suddenly outside of my comfort zone. I usually have a sense of my relationships with people. I make some of them up, but some of them not. And I'm generally at home in the Zendo, in both Zendos. I kind of know what I'm supposed to do and what other people more or less are doing. When I went in that new group, I didn't know. As I said, if I belonged or what my place was, how to stay out of the way. how to stay enough in the way to learn something. So there was some kind of undercurrent of anxiety or fear that persisted for quite a while. I was interested in the teaching of Chögyam Trungpa. You know, he was a brilliant Tibetan teacher who came to this country, I guess in the 70s, last century, and only lived to be 47, died in, I think, 1987, but left a tremendous legacy of many groups and many disciples in this country, and I think must have also left them in other countries. He became close to Suzuki Roshi, and toward the end of Suzuki Roshi's life, he came to San Francisco to be with us as we went through the final days of Suzuki Roshi's life. And he talked with us, and that was comforting to have him. One of the things that he has said that has captured my mind is the ultimate definition of bravery is not being afraid of who you are. That when you go into your mind deeply, completely, regardless of all of the brambles and bushes and reservations and everything that's you don't want to go through, you can't really face, finally you push it aside. That's one of the gestures in Qigong, pushing aside energy. Going through the brambles and reservations and fears of the mind. You have to go through all that to get to what's really at the bottom of it. And I was glad to hear him say, you know, that we don't usually go all the way to the bottom to find out what's there. And so we don't get to face ourselves completely. And because we can't face ourselves completely, there's something about this mind and body that's not met. And so that part that's not met becomes a kind of shadow, maybe, that generates, that continues the fear. We can't penetrate the bottom of our mind. So because I've had enough complications in my teaching career with people and with the teaching, I've had to go pretty deep to investigate my thoughts and feelings, my body. And it's been a real blessing for me. Because there's hardly any... Now, I know this isn't true as soon as I say it. I was about to say there's hardly anything I haven't looked at, but that's not true. I'm sure we keep going and we meet what Trungpa calls all our shit. And we meet the parts of ourselves that we hide from ourselves. Maybe we let ourselves know, but we hide them from everybody else. And that's the part that we keep hidden. So we become divided between the part that we show people, we make public, and the part that we are private about. The ultimate definition of bravery is not being afraid of who you are. So who are we at bottom? What's down there? What are the self-centered self-possess, the things that we possess. All the things the precepts are about ways to work with those attachments to this small self. Fear is anxiety. Fear is a sense of inadequacy. I'm not big enough. I'm not strong enough. I can't do it. If I really had to face some challenge, I wouldn't be up to it. A feeling we may not be able to deal with the challenges of everyday life. And as Trungpa says, we have a fear of facing ourselves, experiencing the innermost core of our existence. This can be quite embarrassing. We're spending so much time trying to hide it. The only time you can be with yourself, says Trungpa, is to begin to give up privacy, that sense of what you personally know that you keep from others. You open your heart and your whole existence to the rest of the world. And then you find greater privacy. He says you find that an actual discovery of yourself is taking place. Well, you know, years ago, I was invited, along with some other women, to contribute to a book that some women editors and writers were producing. They were going to call it Being Bodies. And we were all invited to talk about our body experience. And I'd had a kind of dramatic body experience in the Zendo. It had been very helpful. But I wasn't sure that I should tell the world about it because I had this, what I called my reputation as a teacher, to uphold. Should I let people know what's really going on behind the curtain? Actually, that was actually the question I had. What would people, would I lose my my ability to teach or my reputation or whatever? You know, fear of public speaking, fear of loss of reputation, the five fears, they all came up. And I really, this was a real issue for me. It was before I began talking about everything, as I'm doing now, endlessly. So I was talking, I talked with some of my friends, not necessarily students, but people that have been practicing alongside me. What did they think? Would this totally wipe out my teaching career? And they all said, no, you know, this is going to be helpful. You know, you're going to connect to people. So based on that, I went ahead and produced something. And then when I went in the book, and the book was full of other women who I suspect went through the exact same process because the stories they told about their relationship to their body, their experience of their body was so, they were all so intimate. I couldn't believe it, how revealing these women had been about the actual experience of working with their bodies, knowing their bodies. It's pretty good. It's a really helpful book. It's called Being Bodies, I think. And Susan Moon, who was one of the editors, has written a new one, came out, I don't know, a year or two ago. What is it? This is Getting Old, talking about getting old as a woman. I think it's all about women. You know, and it's the same thing. She's talking about what it's like to be in a woman's body in your 60s or 70s. when Robert Aitken said in one of his something he wrote, I think, about his, he was now in his 80s or 90s. You know, how hard it was to grow old because, you know, you become incontinent. And then he went on to various other things. I thought, oh, thank you for giving me the word. Okay, so incontinence is part of growing old. Happens to all of us. Welcome to the club. And it's kind of, it can be very embarrassing, except in our culture, which makes separation, the front side and the back side, the public side and the private side. I think in cultures where the life is more natural, less fancied up, the actual sounds and activities and experiences of the body are not so embarrassing and humiliating. And they don't separate us so much. So I had also begun to realize that my deepest fear was having to confront my own feelings about my own experiences. This was true in that class that I didn't stay with for a while and then returned to. I found that I was, immediately when I went into the class, I kind of looked for a gestalt based on my experiences. I was looking for who the people were who knew what was going on, who were skillful. Maybe I could learn from them. And who were the people that weren't so skillful, didn't look like they understood it so well. And then everybody else was in between. I kind of had a gestalt of the group. And then at some point, I realized that I was being discouraged by my own projections of what they thought about me because I couldn't hear everything and I couldn't quite follow the instructions. I had to ask for help. And he was willing to give it. Nobody was acting as if I was weird or unprepared or shouldn't be there, except my mind was producing this. It's really something. And after I left and got it clear that it was my mind that was making up the sense of my difficulty in there, returning to the class was more working with my own mind and body rather than studying Qigong. They weren't so separate, but mostly it was, what can I learn now from being in this situation which is uncomfortable and unfamiliar for me? And so I'm sharing it with you because it made me realize that many people who come to the Zen Center probably feel this way. It's unfamiliar. They don't know what the invisible rules about where you bow and where you stand and all of this, which we remind them of, and I've been reminding them of for years. And this just makes people feel bad. Unless we find a way to do it that's more comfortable and more inclusive. So, chewing on this stuff, thinking about it, living through it, I encountered a talk by a social worker, researcher, named Brené Brown, who has been, for the last 10 years or so, studying how people's lives. She has come to realize, she said, that being a social worker with years of experience trying to help people, you realize that connection is why we're here. It's what gives meaning to our lives. Connection. We know that. It's our relationships with each other. In practice, we might call that intimacy, the willingness to really talk about ourselves at a close, personal level. We can do that. For many people, it's the first time they've heard that what their experience of discomfort and feeling of inadequacy, et cetera, inner conflict, that's the way everybody is. We're all like that. We're all feeling inadequate in some way. And we match that with feeling arrogant in some other way sometimes. So the ways in which we come to experience and confess ourselves to a teacher or to each other helps us realize we're not so isolated, closed off as we have feared, that there's something about us that's not acceptable. So she started with connection. How does it work? When she interviewed people about connection, they talked about disconnection. You know, this reminded me of when I take up the practice of patience, I meet my impatience. My impatience reminds me to practice patience. So when she talked to people about connection, interviewed them about it, their experience, they talked about disconnection. And when she looked at what disconnection was about, she found it was about some unnamed thing that completely unraveled connection. And what this turned out to be was shame. The feeling that there is something about me, if people knew about it, I wouldn't be worthy of connection. I wonder if anybody has felt that. In order to become connected, we have to allow ourselves to be really seen, to tell our stories, to see them in print, to confess how ordinary we are, instead of this private, isolated being. She decided to deconstruct shame. It took her about 6 years. She thought originally she'd wrap it up in a year and get back to connection. It took 6 years, maybe longer. She's since published 2 books about it. Pretty interesting. And they're much easier to read than Dogen. Because it's all familiar. She found there were 2 groups in her sample. Those who have a strong sense of love and belonging, and those who do not have a strong sense of love and belonging. And the difference between the 2 groups is that the first group, those who have a strong sense of love and belonging, believe they are worthy of love and belonging. What keeps us out of love and belonging is the feeling that we're not worthy of it. And this goes back, of course, to our original relationship with our mothers. It took me a long time. It's taken me a long time to realize the significance, the primacy of this early relationship. The person who ushers you, releases you into the world, and how close your bond is with this person. If that bond is secure, apparently it communicates something. And that includes in the womb. That includes something that you carry apparently with you the rest of your life. That you're safe in this life. And if that bond is not quite so secure, there have been some complex things happening in the family, as I think happened with many of our families, we don't often get that sense that we're safe in the world in some way. So she had to look at something called not worthy of love and connection, or what she eventually ended up calling wholeheartedness. The people who felt they were worthy of love and connection and lived their lives in that way, in a way of connectedness. She put them in one pile, and she called that pile, how did they live their lives? And the first word that came to her was wholehearted. So at this point, this became our practice, right? How do you live your life in a way that's really connected with everybody? And with something we call the self, which may or may not exist. And she found it was wholeheartedness. And it was maybe close to the decision I made. I don't know, but close to the decision I made in that Qigong class when I decided, well, I'll come back. I'm going to learn something about myself, maybe. I'll be very careful and watch everything that's coming up because I don't know how much Qigong I'll learn. But I'll learn a lot about myself, probably. It's the people who were able here's how she describes it. The word courage, wholeheartedness were people who lived with a sense of courage. She said courage comes from the Latin word cur. I don't know how the Latins would say it. Which is to tell the story of who, when the original meaning of the word when it first came into our language was to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And she says these were people who had the courage to be imperfect. And they also had the compassion to be kind to themselves first, and then kind to other people. Because if you're not kind to yourself, if you're not open to yourself, to your own vulnerabilities, you can't really be open, kind to anyone else. You may think you are, but it's not complete. They could let go of who they thought they should be in order to be who they were. Can I let go of what I think a teacher is in order to be myself? Whatever that self, whatever I think that is. Trungpa has some stuff to say about this too. They also, she said, had in common that they fully embraced vulnerability and believed that what made them vulnerable was what made them beautiful. You know, and it's really like that. This is who I am. You know, I'm confused, uncertain. This is what it takes to live in our kind of world right now. She says we live in a vulnerable world. We know that, not just economically and politically. not safe to talk about what your faith is, what you trust and believe. She learned that the way to... Oh, one of the things she did was she went online and she asked people, what makes you feel vulnerable? And she said within 1 hour she had 150 answers. People wrote back. You know, having to lay somebody off, being laid off, being able to breathe through waiting for the doctor to call back after your mammogram, saying, I love you first, investing in a relationship without knowing if it will work out. I've been having a contretemps, that's a French word, I think, with a doctor who wants me to do something and I don't want to do it. And every time and he keeps me on a pretty tight leash because I don't voluntarily come back to see him usually, unless he makes me come back on an appointment basis. And I just notice that I begin to get apprehensive as the day of my appointment comes because I don't know how we're going to negotiate this. Because I feel pretty strongly I don't want to pursue what he has been recommending. And it turns out now that it looks like I may not have to. But for a while there, we were really at it with each other, and he wasn't making it comfortable for me to have an alternative perspective. And so I was feeling like I needed to take an advocate in with me who could talk more his language. So it's, you know, it's that kind of thing that we all feel, you know. Who can help us through these kinds of interactions? It turned out, the end, I didn't know anybody who I could readily grab. So I went in by myself, and the results were comfortable enough that he didn't give me such a difficult time this time. It's a vulnerable world. We all... I know somebody's going through a divorce, a very painful divorce. She's not an American citizen. And I can't believe that she's doing this by herself. Her husband's giving her some difficulty. He has a different perspective and different interests. He doesn't know it, but they share the same interests. But at one level, it looks like they need to fight. It's really hard for her to prepare herself to go and see the mediator who's helping them go through this. And I've been happy to see that people have stepped up to support her and to encourage her to trust what's coming up for her and to stay true to her own positions, which are a little different from the positions she was taking as a loving wife supporting her husband. And now she finds she has to play another kind of role with him, and that's been a hard transition to make. Life is full of these interesting challenges. You have to go see your teacher. I remember writing my name down on the list to go see my teacher in San Francisco, and then a day later walking up there and crossing my name off the list. And then the next day being called in there and being asked, why did you cross your name off the list? You know, people always come in and say, oh, I answered my own questions. Yeah. That's one of the things we do. We answer our own questions. The thing about Drungpa that I was thinking about, the thing that's so interesting about his writing, which is very bracing and challenging, is that he doesn't tell you what you expect him to say. He uses language that's almost the opposite of what you expect him to say. And also, you know, Dogen does this. You know, Dogen really challenges our normal patterns of thinking. Because if you go deeply enough into your own being, you can't say anything for certain. You know, you can like yourself, but you also don't like yourself. You can say you're a good person and compassionate and loving, and you're also a bitch. You can also be mean and reject. You can find opposites. We exist. They exist within us. And we are, one or the other isn't who we are. You can't say, you can't, if you go deeply enough inside your mind, you know this, if you've been sitting for a while, you know this. Everything is contingent. Everything is relational. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on what you've had for lunch or how you, if you slept that night. All kinds of conditions are present so that nothing has a final resting point. This is a world about movement, about change. You know, in the book Fire Monks, Jane Hirschfield is quoted as telling the people at Tassajara when she was there ahead of this last fire. She stayed with them and did some coaching because she'd been here for the last fire that came to the earlier fire that came to Tassajara. And she said, Buddhism is very simple. I can put it in, I think she said 7 words. Everything changes. What was the other one? Everything. Oh, I had it written down here. Everything is connected. Pay attention. Everything changes. We like that to happen when it's something we don't like. We don't like it to happen when it's whatever, positive, comfortable stuff. What we do with vulnerability. Oh, she had a kind of breakdown, by the way, by the time she went through all this process. She learned that the way to live is to be vulnerable, to live with longing, love and longing, belonging and connection, is to be vulnerable and not be able to predict and control. And she said she came close to a breakdown because the whole point of doing the research in the first place was to be able to predict and control the phenomena that she was studying. Shame, you know, connection, fear. So she went to see a therapist and told the therapist that she didn't want to do any childhood stuff. She just wanted some strategies for sorting this out. And the therapist went. And then she said, what is it about vulnerability? And the therapist said, it's neither good nor bad. It just is. So she realized this was going to be a serious journey. And what she learned from that, that vulnerability was kind of the core of shame and fear and our struggle for worthiness. But it's also the birthplace of joy, creativity, belonging, and love. Vulnerability. This is what she's talking about. The core of shame and fear in our struggle for worthiness. And then she went into why we struggle with vulnerability. Why do we work so hard to avoid it? We numb vulnerability. What makes you feel vulnerable? Having to ask for help? Initiating sex with my husband? Initiating sex with my wife? It's a pretty common experience. She said, "How we deal with it, we numb it. We can't selectively numb the emotions of grief, fear, shame, disappointment, vulnerability, without numbing joy, gratitude, happiness. Because then we're miserable and we're looking for meaning in life." She said, I liked what you said about religion. We make everything that's uncertain, certain. She said, religion was once about belief in faith and mystery. Now we make it about certainty. Make people have to declare they're a Christian or whatever. And she talked a little bit about the fact. That we want our children to be perfect. Instead, we know that they're imperfect. And we want them to know that they're worthy of love and belonging. So when she got to wholeheartedness, although she thought it was a breakdown, her therapist told her she was having a spiritual breakthrough. And she has come to the realization that, living making a sense of this life is to be vulnerable, is to be open, is to be spacious, starting with ourselves. And if I knew how to help us do that, I would tell you. Some people seem to have a harder time of finding worthiness in themselves than others. But one thing she suggested was that we write a memoir. I think she wrote that in one of her books. And although sometimes, to keep me occupied, people have suggested that I write my memoir. why don't you write your experiences or something? And I have never had any interest in that. But after looking at her material and thinking about it, to go back into my life, my early life, might be one way of reconnecting at this stage with the parts of myself that have been so problematic. And I'm now thinking about it, which I kind of it surprises me a little bit. I probably won't do it, but I'm thinking about it. Last Saturday, Frank Ostasevsky, who started the Zen Hospice at the Zen Center in San Francisco, gave a talk. I heard some of it. Susan caught me napping part of it. And when I asked him what drew him to that work, he talked about it being because of his own suffering. What drew him into being with people who are dying and working with them. And he also said that when you look into the eyes of someone who's dying, it's the clearest mirror he's ever had. So he says when people come to the end of their life, they don't talk about other things, how much money they made or other things, their possessions, but they talk about, am I love? And did I love well? So I think what our practice is, what I'm talking about, is our capacity for meeting ourselves, engaging ourselves deeply enough with confidence to actually see what's there. Because what's there is everything. We're a part of the universe, and what we will find inside of ourselves is the same thing we find every place. It's neither good nor bad, it just is. One of the exercises in Qigong is to reach up as high as you can to the heavenly realm, which I talk about and think about as the unconditioned experience, big mind, space, and pull that energy down. And what I experienced as big mind is not good. It's spaciousness, emptiness or spaciousness. So the capacity to be with ourself, regardless of whether we're having a bad day or we're feeling jealous or we're feeling intimidated or whatever, is our capacity to feel spaciousness inside of us, breathing into our body, and just being able to be here with ourselves. So we don't have to numb the desperate feeling of shame or fear or vulnerability. It's the human condition. It's part of what makes us lovable. It's part of what makes us able to connect with each other and share one life. It's also what makes us capable of being loving with others. Thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to end them. Surpassable.